our priestly service to the Lord. And this takes place as we are transformed in our minds, and we get to prove what is the will of God in our lives. You get to demonstrate it, and God's will is shown forth, put in, fleshed out. And so when we come to this element of saying, okay, I want to do God's will, my life is His, He has saved me, I've been bought with a price, what does that look like? Well, it looks like ministering to other people in the church. It means that God has given us grace by which we can minister grace to other people. So God wants to empower you in a particular way, and there's a diversity of ways that God does, and we call these spiritual gifts, that the Spirit of God works in us to produce something in the lives of other people. And so this starts off with a sober assessment of ourselves, not thinking more highly than we ought to think of ourselves, having a humble recognition that it's not about me, but it's really about God and His ability. And so that humble thought doesn't mean I can't do anything. It just means that whatever I can do, it's because of God's grace working in my life. And so then we looked at those individual gifts that bring us to that place and how we can minister one to another in the body of Christ. And I did want to kind of come back. I thought about it a little bit later. There was one that I thought, you know, I was kind of emphasizing one thing, and I really didn't come back and emphasize the other part. It was on the ministry of giving. And I do think that part of God gives the gift of giving to those who have something to give. But I don't want it to sound like someone who doesn't have something, has very little, cannot have the gift of giving. I think that is certainly true as well. And I know that there are those who don't have much and yet sacrifice a lot. In terms of what they do have, they give a lot. And there's the principle of the widow's mite, you know, casting in all that she had in that aspect. And that really is, I think, a spiritual giftedness too of sacrifice to the Lord. So I don't want to diminish that in any way. But it was very encouraging to me to go through each one of these and just study them out and see that there we have speaking gifts, we have serving gifts, and that whatever God's gifted us to do, let's give ourselves to it and dedicate ourselves to that. So now we come to verse 9 through 12, and we'll see how far we can to get through this section. And verse 9 says, let love be without dissimulation. And so as you read through this, you kind of see that there were 7 spiritual gifts that are being identified, and all of a sudden now he's going to start giving commands. And I think that this is not meant to be like, sometimes like preachers will do this. They'll be like, okay, how do I apply something to someone's life? And I'm going to apply to this. I'll kind of touch on this area, and then I'll touch on this area. And it's kind of like maybe a little bit of a shotgun type format where it's just, it's here and there and all over the place, and you'll hit somebody. You know, it'll affect or touch someone's life in some way. And that's perfectly legitimate. But I think what's going on here is something much more precise. He is not just saying, okay, some of you need this command and some of you need this command. But really, he's going to give one command, and then he's going to flush out what that one command is. And in fact, it's actually in the structure of these commands. You don't see it necessarily in the English, but in the Greek, you have an imperative, and there's only one imperative. And that imperative is love without dissimulation. Then all of the others are what we call participles, main verbs and participles. So what they can do in Greek is they can tell you, here's the main idea, and then when you add a participle, it says it's connected to this idea. And you kind of have to figure out what the connection is through the context. And sometimes they'll have some actual grammatical markers that will indicate what that is. But in this connection, this is what they call imperative. And now I'm off in the woods, so I don't know if we can keep going down that rabbit hole. But there is a specific technical term for these participles that make them commands. These are participles that are commands. So even though it's not in the imperative mood, because it's tied to an imperative verb, they are commands, and therefore they're translated as commands for us here. So I'm saying it's absolutely right, but there's an added layer that lets you know there's one main focus, and everything else is just describing what it means to love. What does it mean to love God? What does it mean to love one another without dissimulation? And it's interesting to me that every passage that deals with spiritual gifts, I think the longest of them is 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and 1 Corinthians chapter 14. 1 Corinthians 12, 1 Corinthians 14. What's in the middle between 12 and 14? 13. All right, good. But I'm not asking for a math lesson here. What? The love chapter. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is all about love. You go to 1 Peter and or Ephesians, where it talks about how he gives some apostles and some evangelists and some prophets and pastors, teachers, so that the body may edify itself in love, speaking the truth in love. So anytime we're talking about spiritual gifts, there's an engine that drives ministry, that drives service. And this is an all-important concept from God, that we have to have a spirit of love. We know from 1 Corinthians that you can do great things for other people. You can give all your money away. You can give your body to be burned. But if you don't have a spirit of genuine love, then it really is worthless. And what's interesting here, he points this out. He says, let love be without dissimulation. Dissimulation is another word for hypocrisy. It means the idea of putting on a mask, putting on a face, putting on a front. There's an aspect that we could boil it down and say, what is a life given over and presented to God? Say, God, I'm yours. You can use me. What's it going to look like? When God gets a hold of that life, what you are going to experience in interacting with that life, what people are going to have in relationship to you, is they're going to know that you genuinely love them. And so this is a neat way. In some ways, you can boil down the Christian life down to one word, and that's a love for God and love for others. And so, what that means is, it's possible to have a love or to have the appearance of love. And so love that really is not genuine. Have you ever had a conversation with someone that, you know, they're always proper and they're always polite, but they feel distant and aloof to you? So they're not saying anything mean, but you really just feel like you can't get close to them. They're kind of holding you at arm's distance. Ever felt like that? I mean, there's an aspect, you ever have a conversation with them? You ever try to bring that out in the open and say, I don't think you love me. Probably not the way that we start off a conversation like that. But you know, I'm sure we've all had a conversation like that where you're trying to argue with someone to prove to them that they don't, and then how do they respond? What? What are you talking about? Of course I love you. You know, what I mean is, it's hard to prove to someone else that they don't love you. There's an element of, you know, there's something, you may feel like something's wrong, but we can understand this, that love is, talk is cheap. Observable actions on the surface is not what he's going for here. He's talking about something that really is deep down inside of our souls. It's genuine. And I honestly believe that if we're going to have a love that we're supposed to have, love comes out of the life of God flowing through us. So when I in a relationship with God means that I am experiencing, reveling in, receiving the love that God has for me. And that's the life of God towards me. God is pouring out His life, His love, His light towards me. And I'm walking in fellowship with Him. I'm walking in the light. I'm living in light of His love. And that is the transformation. That's the glory that God's face is shining toward me. And I'm being changed as I see the character of God. I'm being changed from one image to the next so that my life becomes more light-filled, more loving, more life. I've got a greater abundancy of life in my life. So I think there's an aspect that we Don't just say, okay, I got to love. You better screw your faucet, I mean your hose, to the faucet of God's love. And say, God, I want to receive your love so that I can turn around and be loving towards other people. And I believe that he actually gives us some tests by which we can test our love for other people. And he says here, these two commands go together. Abhor that which is evil and cleave to that which is good. So, you may ask, well, what does this have to do with love? Abhorring evil, cleaving to that which is good. Well, if you love somebody, then it begins to make sense. Because anything that's evil damages the person that I love. And the greater I love that person, the greater my abhorrence is for the evil that hurts them, and the more I love and cleave to something that's good. So it's actually love that causes us to be morally discriminating. Do you see that in the text? Am I making that up? Love, let your love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. If you have a genuine love for someone else, you will be morally discriminating. Now, I want to... There is an aspect to which this may not seem revolutionary, but this, what I'm teaching you right now, is, I think, very biblical and is at the heart of a giant split in Christianity. A giant swath of Christianity looks at things and says, we need to love people. And their definition of love means, but the way they define love means, you do not make this type of discrimination. In fact, that kind of discrimination has one word for it. It's called being... Nobody knows what that means. I'm so far away from that, I don't even know what that word means. Judgmental. you go around and you see, well, that this is evil and that's good, and you're making all these judgments. In fact, I came across this in my studies of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which he's a complicated individual. He died, was killed by the Nazis. And he took a stand against the Nazis. And so there's an aspect of, he's often in many camps seen as a hero. And some of the things that he says are very thought-provoking. I read his book on discipleship. I did a study on him. But I've found quite a few things that indicate that he definitely was in the camp of New Orthodoxy. New Orthodoxy is, do you believe in the resurrection? Absolutely. It's the most transforming, powerful truth that's ever been told. Jesus Christ being raised from the dead is the pattern for our lives and gives us life eternal. All right, if you were there on the day of the resurrection, you were at the tomb, what happened? I don't know. Meaning, New Orthodoxy means we accept the truth and we deny the historicity of the facts. How do you get to a place like that? You say, Jonah is a wonderful story. You can learn so many great things that will guide your life. Did Jonah get swallowed by a whale? Not really. That was just a myth. That was a story that was told to help people to understand these things. That's New Orthodoxy. And that has had a big impact on a lot of different people. I'm not saying all of New Evangelicalism, but that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was in that camp. And he would write certain things that were very much against Bible-believing Christians, and so I don't look at him as a champion of the faith. So, though his life is very complicated, and I understand that, and if you have evidence to the contrary, I would hope I'm not against him in terms of I pray that he really. I mean, I did a whole paper on him in college, and I just got done thinking, I hope this man was saved for all that he went through and for all that he said that was good and right. I'm not really sure. But anyway, I digress. The point is, he, and I don't know if he was the originator of this or if it came from other points, but I came across this idea that the tree in the garden was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And for him, his understanding was that to make a discriminating choice between good and evil was the original sin. So the original sin was being judgmental. And so for him, when they chose that, they chose a means by which they were the arbitrators of good and evil at that point, and they were able to make decisions. Now, I say all that to say, being judgmental is not good, okay? It is looking into the motives of other people and ascribing things to things that we don't know and making a judgment on, passing a judgment on someone else as if we are God. James deals with that very harshly in terms of the pride that dwells up in our hearts. And we can have that, and that's not good. And we ought to run from that. We ought to suspect ourselves of that type of thing. But the reality is, in the garden, there was a tree of life, and there was a tree of knowledge and good and evil. And they had to eat of the good one, and they couldn't eat of this one. That itself is making a discrimination, is it not? So every time they ate of the good and didn't eat of the one that they were not to, they were making a choice between good and evil. And so while they were upright and while they were doing what was right, they were choosing what was right. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, in my understanding, means that once you choose evil, you will know the difference between good and evil. Because Adam and Eve, all they knew was good. But as soon as they chose evil, now they understood what evil was like. And what is it? As soon as they ate of that, they realized that they were naked. And they had lost their innocency, their moral condition before God, and they died spiritually in that sense. And so I think this is an aspect that says, as soon as you start making choices and say, I believe this is evil, and I believe this is good, and we need to cleave to that which is good, and we need to abhor that which is evil, there's going to come a cry from those who are even believers in Jesus Christ that are going to say, intolerance. And I don't think that's against love. I think it's the true expression of love. That it's incumbent on each and every one of us to find out what is the will of God, what is good, and cleave to that, and don't let it go. There's a sense of real zeal behind this. This is not just passivity. This is not a casual acquaintance. This is a commitment. This is a clinging. This is an embracing and holding on to that which is good, and then abhorring that which is evil. And I think there are things in our society and in our world today that we ought to be able to identify and say, oh man, if I love God, I've got to abhor that. And there are teaching, there's doctrine, false doctrine, that if we love God, we've got to abhor that. I just got a letter in the mail this week capitalizing on, and maybe you'll get something like this too, someone's a Jehovah's Witness sending out letters to people in the community and sending out tracts and things. And you see that false doctrine. You know what pernicious teaching they have about Jesus Christ. And you're like, I abhor this. I love those people. I don't know who they are. You know, I'd love for them to be saved. But, there are things that we ought to say, man, I pull back from that because it is evil. You say, well, what are the good things that we ought to cling to? And there's some sense in which he's going to continue to go on and describe these things to us. He says, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love. The word brotherly love comes from our word that we get Philadelphia. City of brotherly love. Go to Philadelphia and see how true that is. But you know, the Philadelphia Eagles are the only ones I know that boo Santa Claus. All right, so I don't know. I don't get a real good sense of Philadelphia being a place of brotherly love. But that's what the word here is. This philos, and the kindly affection here is kind of has this aspect that when we have a love for one another, it really heightens the natural affections that we have. We're all a part of a group. We all come to this building, but it's more than just that we are associated because we're in Bourbon County, or we're from Fort Scott, or we know each other. But there is a sense in which we look at ourselves as family. We love each other with brotherly love. We're brothers, we're sisters, and that kind of family connection, it just is such a beautiful thing. And he says, the love that believers should have one for another is more intense, and it's more filled with kindness than just normal acquaintances that we have. And he goes on and says, in honor, preferring one another. This idea of going before someone or leading can have the idea of, you're going. It's almost like you're going out of your way to prefer someone else. It's trying to. I guess the best illustration that you can have of this is, you know, someone comes to the door, and both persons are trying to figure out how to get there first to open the door for somebody else. It's going to the restaurant and both people grabbing the check, you know, and trying to, you know, you're trying to figure, you want to show honor to that person. That is your desire. And honor preferring one another. There's an element that, you know, it's hard to have a falling out with somebody whom you are showing honor and respect to. It's hard to get up. And many times our difficulties or our rubs or the things that cause us the wrong way is when someone didn't show me the honor that I deserved. And our focus becomes about, does everybody see me the way I should be seen? Is everyone treating me the way they think of me as well as I want them to think of me? When it should be all about saying, no, you're before me. And the word that's used here is also used in Philippians chapter 2, where it says, in humility of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. That we come to the church and we have a mindset that is looking around saying, how can I honor these people? What can I do to show them that they are valuable, that they are honorable? This is, it's interesting. This, the wrong kind of thing, the bitterness that comes in, and the unloving churches have conflict, have just things that things can just split wide open. I just feel like I'm hearing about different situations. I'm just so thankful for our church here and for the love that we have. And there's aspect, there's no factions, there's no fighting, there's no seeking prominence. It's just, and the bitterness that comes often is because they're not seeking honor or respect to be giving it. And it's the exact opposite happens. Like, I think of it in terms of this example. I heard a pastor talking about in this way, where someone left the church, and he was talking to them and said, so why did you leave the church? And everything came back to him. And they said, well, nobody was meeting my needs. And he said, okay, so if that's the right perspective, and you come to church every time and you think nobody's meeting my needs, and then you think, if that's the way everyone should feel, because that's the right way to feel when you come to church, is everybody meeting my needs, then that person over there, they're going to say, well, nobody's meeting my needs. And everybody's going to say, no one's meeting my needs. The only way people meet people's needs is if you come to church and you say, whose needs can I meet? Because if you have that mentality, then you don't have the mentality, nobody's meeting my needs. Because you're so concerned and filled with trying to meet other people's needs. The point is, whatever that person or situation was in, they've got the wrong mindset, completely reversed. And ultimately, no church would have any members if everybody has that mindset, because nobody's needs would ever get met. It has to be completely reversed. And so in terms of honor and respect, we ought to go out of our way to say, how can I demonstrate to you? You know, is there something that I can do? Can I take the servile position? Oh, it was my fault. It was my mistake. It was my bad. You know, instead of arguing about pushing it on to someone else, be ready and willing to acknowledge wherever there's a sense of, I'm not sure who made the mistake, But be ready to accept that responsibility yourself. And just those things that you can do that demonstrate honor to others. And then he goes on here and says, not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. This aspect here, serving the Lord, has the idea of being a slave to God. You think, you know, in the Roman period of time, slavery was a big deal. All kinds of slaves, all kinds of ethnicities, all throughout the Roman Empire. Anybody who was conquered, they would be sent off and they would be dispersed and they would be sent off, sold as slaves. Slavery was just rampant through the Roman Empire. How many slaves do you think were happy about it? Probably not many. And here's this aspect that he's saying, you are the slave of the Lord, and yet you can demonstrate a totally different attitude in service. That if you're not happy about something, you're going to be like my kids, all right? And you got to do, okay, I'll do it. You know, it's human nature. We kind of, if our heart's not in it, everybody can tell our heart's not in it. And he says, don't be slothful in business. This area of what God has given you to do and the work that he's given you to do, don't be lazy. Don't be this aspect of allowing something just to sluggishness. You think about the talents. God gave to 10 and to 2 and to 1, and he responded to the 1. He says, thou wicked and slothful servant. You didn't do anything with what I gave you. And here we're talking about spiritual gifts, and you've been called to serve the Lord, and your body has been presented to him. He says, don't be slothful, but in fact, be fervent in spirit. That word fervent has the idea of bubbling up. You're on fire. You're like a kettle that's like, and you're just bubbling over and the lid can't stay on because something is going on inside of you. You've been ignited. And I think this idea of spirit is a dual function word that has the idea inside of you, inside of your spirit, on the inside, you're bubbling up and you're fervent. Why? Because the Spirit of the Lord. The cross-reference for this is Acts chapter 18, where it talks about Apollos, who was fervent in the Spirit. The Spirit of God is the one that stirs up our hearts to do something in business, in service, in sacrifice, in love for others. And if we have a true love for God and a true love for others, it will show because we're not half-hearted in the service that we give. No, we're zealous. We're affected. We're on fire. We have an opportunity to serve the Lord. There's an emotion aspect of this, fervent in spirit, but there is really a sense of channeling and directing emotion. You can't just say, oh, I'm just filled with the Spirit. Woo! And you got all kinds of emotional fervency that's shown and it looks big. But he says, there's an aspect that says that fervency has a way of expressing itself. And that's in service. That's in humility. I'm the first one to grab the towel and the basin because I want to wash the disciples' feet. I want to serve. That is true love, is it not? Isn't that what John 12 teaches us? He says, if you love me, keep my commandments. I was among you as one who serves. And he pictures ultimately the cross to what he's doing that. And so there an aspect of, I love Jonathan Edwards. He makes this resolution. He made many of them, but one that sticks out. He says, I am resolved to live with all my might while I live. I am resolved to live with all my might while I live. Whatever your hand finds to do, do with all your might. Be stirred up towards the Lord. And I think that's about as far as we can get here this morning. So we'll finish there. May God help us to be zealous for Him and serving our God.